people might still be drifting back for March, but I think we'll kick off because I think Shauna's got a fair bit of material for us to get through today. So my name's Nadine Wilmot. I work at AMP, and it's my pleasure to be chairing this afternoon's session. I've sat in sessions before run by Shauna, and I know they're always entertaining, enjoyable, and you learn a few things. We're going to run this a little bit differently. Instead of having a presentation and a formal Q&A, Shauna really would like questions as we go along. So if something sort of occurs to you, please just come up to the mic and raise your question then and there. I think in particular you're keen to hear from people who might know a little bit about the background of this case and to sort of add to the insights. Probably many of you know Shauna. I think you thought there might be a fair few of your ex-students here. But for those who don't, Shauna graduated from Macquarie and then started working at Aetna Life. I think there was a bit of a career sidestep at the stage because the bio information says after a couple of years of working with delinquent teenagers, she discovered that she had no talent for social work, so I came back into the actuarial field. Then worked at Munich Re and the Commonwealth Bank, and then in 1993 joined Macquarie and has been there ever since. So teaches on financial institutions management and regulation and has written a number of case studies on financial fiascos to keep students entertained and help them develop a better understanding of enterprise risk management. So with that, I'll hand over to Shauna and thanks. Off we go.
Thank you very much. Okay, well, today I'm really just going to be giving an overview of what happened at the Equitable Life Assurance Society in the UK, with a few comments along the way about what we can learn from it. So just for those of you who are not familiar with the history of the Equitable, it was the oldest life insurance company, life insurance society in the UK, established in 1762. And it's a mutual society, no shareholders, owned by the policyholders, and run by a group of directors. During my teaching of actuarial studies, I often refer to the Equitable because they were such a pioneer in so many areas of actuarial thought, being the first really successful life insurance company. They had to work out the answers to a whole lot of difficult questions about valuation and reserving and bonus distribution. They didn't always get it right, but they did come up with some interesting ideas. By the 1990s, they were in the top 10 of the UK insurance offices, and they had £33 billion in assets. So they were pretty big. But as a result of a number of types of mismanagement, they closed a new business at the end of the year 2000, and policyholder benefits were slashed in the following year, and it's now in runoff. They have about £6 billion left, so they're down to less than 20% of what their assets were just 12 years ago. There has already been an incredible amount of stuff written about what happened at the Equitable, all written from different perspectives. The House of Lords had to decide a case involving the Equitable, and they did a sort of legal analysis of what went wrong. The Financial Services Association Authority in the UK wrote a report about what they did wrong themselves. House of Commons asked Lord Penrose to do a review of the Equitable and what went wrong, and he produced a report that's several hundred pages long. A couple of QCs were hired to do a report into mis-selling. The Institute of Actuaries wrote a report about how to revise professional standards and disciplinary requirements in light of what happened at the Equitable. The Institute of Actuaries also had a disciplinary panel. Three of the actuaries who worked at the Equitable were called up on professional misconduct charges. One of them was expelled from the Institute, and the other two had basically already retired, and they were just admonished. And the Parliamentary Ombudsman put out a report in 2008, which was actually quite scathing. She called it Equitable Life, a Decade of Regulatory Failure. It's another report that's several hundred pages long, pointing out everything that everyone did wrong along the way. It's, I think it's one of the most informative reports because I think enough time had gone by so that she could be a bit more honest than some of the other reports in revealing the details of what went wrong. So if you want to look at a list of reports, I've put the website up there. There are actually like hundreds of documents which are publicly available discussing different aspects of the case, but all from different perspectives. Some are looking at the regulatory aspects, some are looking at the actuarial aspects, some are looking at the market conduct aspects, and so on. So what I wanted to do in this paper was to do a relatively concise summary. It's actually about 50 pages long, so it's not as concise as I hoped it would be at the start. But what I really wanted to do was look at the equitable in the context of actuarial thought and practice. What was happening in the actuarial world at the time, and so I've tried to read through the Journal of the Institute of Actuaries papers and faculty papers to see how what the equitable was doing fitted in with what everyone else was doing and what they thought. There are some lessons to the actuarial profession, and I would have to say that the collapse of the equitable was extremely damaging to the reputation of the profession. Lloyd Penrose in particular had a lot of negative comments about the actuarial profession scattered through his report. And the lessons for the prudential supervisors. The prudential supervisors, the system of regulation changed over time, but they really did not do a very good job in supervising the equitable. And when they were challenged about it later, they said, well, they had been told that they should supervise with a light touch. This was the government deregulatory approach in those days, was that you should let the management make their own decisions and you shouldn't actually interfere too much unless they're actually breaching some regulations. And I think it would be fair to say that there was some regulatory capture. The regulators seem to regard it as their job to protect the insurance companies more than protect policyholders. Now, I'm hoping that there will be some people here in the audience who have worked in the UK and may be more familiar with what happened there. I have asked a couple of UK actuaries to help me, and sometimes it really gives you an insight to know what everyone who works in the UK knows, but people in Australia may not be familiar with. So if you have experience and you think I've got anything wrong, please put your hand up and wave at me, or tell me later on. So I'm just going to... First, section one of this paper is just a bit of background about what was happening to the equitable during this period. And actually, despite its illustrious history, by the early 1970s, the equitable was really quite a small and conservatively run insurance group association. I'm going to call them a company, even though they're a society. But they were in danger of going even further downhill because they had one big customer, a university-related super scheme, that provided most of their premium income. And due to some regulatory changes, they were going to lose that line of business. So they decided that they had to, if they were going to survive, they would have to adapt, and they would move out and try and grow their business in other areas. So they set up better marketing systems, they set up more branch offices, and they adopted a very growth-oriented approach. And as you can see, they were incredibly successful in growing the company, and in particular, from about 1987 up to about 1996, they had really excellent rates of growth, and most of this time they were under the control, the appointed actuary was a guy called Roy Ranson, who later got was quite severely criticised. So in 1998 they started getting a bit of bad publicity, which I'll tell you about later, and by the end of 2000, of course, their new business income had dropped basically to zero because they had to close for new business by the end of 2000. So it was a rocket up and a rocket down, I suppose. Bit of a roller coaster ride there. Oops, sorry, wrong mouse. The product that they mostly sold was what's called a recurrent single premium policy, which was a kind of what we would call capital guarantee. They called it a kind of managed fund approach. You'd put your premium, you'd pay your premium in at the start to initiate the policy. It would be... expenses would be deducted, it would go into an account, it would accumulate with interest, expenses and life insurance charges would be deducted, and bonuses would be added from time to time reflecting the investment experience. And at the end, when you got to retirement age, you could to some extent take a cash benefit, though in the UK there are restrictions on taking cash. You can only take 25% of your benefit as cash in many cases. You could buy an annuity at current market rates, either from the Equitable or from someone else, or you could buy an annuity at a guaranteed rate. And I'm going to use GAR to stand for guaranteed annuity rate, and GAO stands for guaranteed annuity option. So the customer had a choice when he got to retirement, and this, of course, guarantee is eventually what caused the Equitable an incredible amount of trouble. Oops. Now, the reasons for this phenomenal success were, they had some good reasons for growing fast. They were well known for having the lowest expense ratios in the industry. According to the reported expense ratios, anyway, they were about half of the market average. They didn't pay any commission to financial advisors, so that was considered to be a very good selling point. The Consumer Association thought this was a big plus for the Equitable. And they also tried very hard to have good customer service. But one of the main reasons that they were able to grow so quickly is because they had really good bonus rates. In the 1980s and 1990s, the UK financial press used to publish performance league tables for all the different life offices showing who had the best bonus rates for different products and different maturities. And the Equitable was usually near the top of the list, which their excellent bonus structure helped them to attract a lot of new business. And this was a very key part of their marketing strategy, was to stay at the top of the performance league tables. So my outline for the rest of this presentation is we're going to talk about aspects of the management of this company, starting with the estate, the bonuses, their valuation and reporting standards, what happened when the guaranteed annuity rates moved into the money, the aftermath, what happened to the society after the House of Lords decision, and just a few little final comments on corporate governance and ERM. I just put that in because I know that ERM is very trendy these days, and you'd all come and listen if I put in stuff about ERM. Now, linking this back to actuarial thought, one of the key papers for understanding what happened at the Equitable is this paper called With Profits Without Mystery. And it was presented to the Institute of Actuaries in 1989 and to the faculty in 1990. And the authors were Roy Vanson, who was the appointed actuary at the time, and Chris, I think it's pronounced Hedden, who was one of his assistants in the actuarial department. And in this paper, they set out their principles for running a with-profits fund, basically describing their philosophy for how they proposed to run the Equitable. And they had some pretty controversial ideas. When they presented this paper to the rest of the profession, they always have a discussion of papers at the end, and there was definitely some people who were quite critical of their proposals. There were some people who, you know, were strongly in favour of their proposals as well. But it's interesting to read the discussion. Some of the people in the discussion identified flaws in the strategy that turned out to be dead right. So first of all, just looking at the estate, a term that is probably more familiar to British actuaries than to Australian actuaries. But it basically means the reserves, the excess of the assets over the liabilities. There's a lot of more complicated definitions, but that's roughly what it boils down to. And the question that was addressed in With Profits Without Mystery is, how much is enough? How much of an estate does an insurance company really need? The government, of course, set minimum solvency standards, but the question was, how much should an insurance company keep over and above the minimum that was required by law? So at the time, there was a lot of controversy about inherited estates. Some of the life offices, which were proprietary offices with shareholders, had been accused of building up excessive amounts of reserves, which were basically being siphoned out of the policyholders' pockets and siphoned into the pockets of the shareholders. And there was some concern. There were a few cases that where the government at least felt that policyholders had been not treated fairly. So companies that built up two large estates were treated with suspicion. There was also a really interesting paper by Frank Reddington, who is, of course, one of the most famous actuaries in the UK profession. He published a paper called A Flock and a Sheep and Other Essays in 1981, which also expressed the view that sometimes insurance companies had been too conservative in setting up large reserves, and that this was possibly detrimental to their policyholders, because the policyholders, of course, had to sacrifice some of their bonuses in order to build up the estate. So Reddington's paper, you know, was also saying maybe we've gone too far down to the high end of the estates. And in particular for a mutual, the only way you can build up an estate, especially for a rapidly growing company like the Equitable, is to withhold benefits from the current generation of policyholders to help build up that estate. And I just put health funds in brackets there because I know one of the other sessions, which is on concurrently with this one, so unfortunately you can't hear both, is discussing this very issue in relation to Australian mutual health funds, where there's been some criticism of health funds for building up excessive amounts of free reserves, and maybe that this isn't in the best interest of policyholders. Though I believe the paper that's been presented is in favour of keeping high reserves and using them for the benefit of policyholders. So the traditional approach was a large estate provides better security for the policyholders. It allows you to smooth your bonus rates over time, gives you extra flexibility in your investments, and provides funds to support the growth of new business if you've got new business strength. But in With Profits Without Mystery, the Equitable Actuaries paper, they argued in favour of what they called full and fair distributions. They said that building up large estates is not equitable because it means that the one generation of policyholders has to build up the estate for the benefit of future generations. And they took a very strong line saying they did not want to have any intergenerational transfers. That would not be equitable. And they also said that by having a minimal estate, they could have full bonuses or higher bonuses. They expressed in all of their PR stuff that they put out, they expressed this as being a matter of principle that they wanted to give full benefits to all their policyholders. But if you're cynical like me, it was in fact very convenient for them to be able to declare higher bonuses because, of course, they were very keen on growing as rapidly as possible, and high bonuses was a key part of their investment strategy. So although they kept saying they were giving high bonuses as a matter of principle, it was very, very convenient that it also helped them to grow their company rapidly. I said it's kind of, they were making a virtue out of necessity. They didn't have as much estate, as much free reserves as the other companies, and they didn't want to declare lower bonuses. So they sort of had this PR campaign where they tried to convince other people that having a large free estate was not a good idea. So this is a quote from With Profits Without Mystery. It must be asked why strength is of itself a desirable feature. You need to have an adequate level of strength to avoid having the regulator, the Department of Trade and Industry, give you a hard time. But there really isn't any point in building up a level of strength which is higher than required by regulations. In fact, those other companies that have a high level of strength, they're just doing that because they're not giving you a good return on your premiums. They had a lot of criticism of what they called so-called strength in their competitors. Now, I don't think it was so-called strength. I think their competitors actually were stronger than them, but they tended to kind of disparage the companies that had large returns by saying that they were not being fair to their policyholders. So here's a set of graph showing what they call a free assets ratio, which is your excess of your assets over your liabilities divided by your liabilities. Yes. And as you can see, this is the top 8 insurance companies in the UK from 1989 to 1998, and this black line along the bottom is the Equitable. So their free assets ratio, which was considered to be a measure of financial strength, was definitely considerably lower than most of their competitors throughout the 1990s. And as I'll tell you later, this is actually it's actually much worse than this because they were let's say that their accounting solvency margin did not reflect the reality of their position. It was actually much weaker than you would think from looking at that graph. Any questions so far? No? Okay, I know I tend to take over. So the next thing we want to look at is...
Yep. Just one question. Did their campaign have an impact there, though, in 1999? Because everyone's ratio did seem to drop.
Oh, the main reason the ratios dropped was because they had a really bad stock market returns in 1990. We'll get to that in a minute, actually. So the next thing was, of course, it's risky to... the appointed actuary knew that it was risky to run an insurance company with low reserves. But he said, well, we can manage that risk by having a really well-thought-out bonus policy. So in With Profits Without Mystery, he set out his principles for management of distribution of surplus. And he basically said, to be equitable to our customers, what we want to do is make sure that the benefits we pay closely reflect the asset share. He said it was like a managed fund, like a unit-linked fund. You put your money in, it gets invested, investment returns get added, and whatever comes out at the end, that's your benefit. So he advocated that benefits should closely reflect asset share. And if, of course, you have no estate to smooth out any fluctuations, then, of course, your benefits must fluctuate up and down in line with experience because you don't have any smoothing reserves available. He did say in the paper that it was very important to smooth your bonus rates, but he didn't really explain how the smoothing policy would work. And this was a matter of some comment in the discussions at the end of the meeting. Some of the more senior actuaries who were there sort of said, well, you want to have no estate. You claim that you're going to be smoothing the bonuses, but you haven't really explained how you're going to manage smoothing when you don't have any smoothing reserves. And they pointed out that the goal of having assets reflecting asset shares and assets being smooth were two inconsistent objectives, and they should work out some method of smoothing that they could disclose to their customers. One actor in particular said, there's a risk when you're smoothing, if you don't do it right, that you might overcredit and damage the solvency of your office. And that turned out to be a very perceptive and foresighted comment. Actually, I think they might have already been overcrediting, and this guy knew that they were doing it. But because as soon as this philosophy was put to the test, it failed. Because what happened was in 1990, there were extremely poor investment returns. The blue bars represent the earned rate net of expenses from the Equitable's accounts. And theoretically, the paper With Profit Without Mystery was put out in 1989. The very next year, there was a terrible stock market crash. And the Equitable had to decide whether they were going to follow their stated philosophy and reduce their bonuses, or whether they were going to keep their bonus rates high. And of course, what happened was they abandoned the the theory of letting bonus rates fluctuate up and down, because they knew if they put their bonus rates down that they would have the problem of difficulty in selling new business. So they decided to keep a high bonus rate. These are the bonus rates up here, despite the fact that they had completely dismal returns. Now the question is, of course, they didn't have any estate, so where do you think they got the money from? If they were making minus 12% and paying plus 12%, there's a bit of a discrepancy there. What would you do if you were the actuary of the company?
Put in a negative reserve.
Okay. Well, I don't know exactly how you do that, but what Mr. Ransom did was he just decided to change all evaluation assumptions to release $550 million of reserves by just reducing the present value of liabilities. They did the same thing again in 1994, which was another bad year for investment returns. They still kept their investment returns high. This was later called a policy of smoothing through the peaks. We'll just ignore the bad years and smooth through the good years. So an effective smoothing strategy works like this. Sometimes your benefits paid are higher than your asset shares, And sometimes your benefits paid are lower than your asset shares. That's how smoothing is supposed to work. But the Equitable pursued a fairly ineffective smoothing policy because this shows the the ratio of the policy values, that's the total benefit payments promised to people who are maturing, relative to the assets. And as you can see, during 1990, they were actually paying out maturity values that were 126% of the asset values. And similarly, in 1994, another bad year, they were paying out bonuses, benefits that were about 120% of the asset values. This is not a good long-term strategy, okay? You keep paying out more money than you're earning. It's not good for your company. On average, during this period, the ratio of the policy values to the asset values was 113%. So this was later strongly criticized by Lord Penrose, who said they didn't really have a smoothing policy at all. It was very, very ad hoc when they made bonus decisions. The total impact of all this overcrediting was that they paid out, they overpaid by about $900 million, over that 10-year period, which really meant that they were gradually weakening the financial strength of the society. And the second problem really was that they were spending money on the current generation of policyholders that would then no longer be available to pay the next generation of policyholders. So despite the fact that the Equitable had taken this stand in 1989 when they published With Profits Without Mystery, saying that they did not want to have one generation cross-subsidising the next generation, this is exactly what was happening. The actuary who came in 1997 said, we have now overcredited by so much that in the future we'll only be able to give people 90 to 95% of their asset shares. And he said, this is going to be difficult to justify, seeing we've always boasted about, you know, how fair we are in our allocated returns. The result of this after the Equitable collapsed was that Mr. Ranson, who was the appointed actuary at the time, was found guilty of professional misconduct, and he was in fact actually expelled from the Institute of Actuaries. There's a whole series of charges against him, but one of them was that he did not keep track of the relationship between total policy values and the value of the fund. He did not keep track and report to the board of the cumulative cost of overpayment of claims and the likely adverse effect on the future values of policies belonging to the policyholders who were still there and the time required to bring the fund back into balance. So basically they were saying he let them overcredit and this was going to have a negative impact on future generations. I should point out that if you look at the papers, all the other insurance, well, not all the other insurance, because many of the competitors were doing exactly the same thing, and they were also overcrediting, and for exactly the same reason, because they wanted to improve their ranks in the performance tables. Mr. Ranson brought this up at this disciplinary hearing and said, you know, we had to keep overcrediting because everybody else was doing it and we needed to stay in line with our competitors. But the disciplinary committee didn't agree. They said, well, maybe the other guys were overcrediting too, but maybe they could afford to do it and you couldn't. You didn't have any estate because you didn't want to have an estate. I should point out that also that when you read the reviews of the regulation, the regulators were definitely concerned about a lot of the other companies at the time, and in fact Equitable was not even at the top of their list of risky companies, but of course they don't tell you the names of all the other risky ones. I'll never find out. One of the things that made the bonus strategy so difficult was the switch from traditional reversionary bonuses to terminal bonuses. Under the traditional reversionary bonus system, if you declared a bonus, it was guaranteed, it couldn't go down, you had to hold reserves for it. And the method of valuation and solvency regulation led to a fairly disciplined release of surplus over time. But during the 1960s, a lot of the life insurance companies started to invest heavily in equities, which of course fluctuate up and down. And as a result, they developed this terminal bonus system where they could declare a bonus, it would last for as long as the insurance company wanted it to. It could go up or down at any time. It was not guaranteed. No reserves were required. And this led to some very undisciplined distribution of surplus, because you could declare a very large terminal bonus, just pay it out to the people who were maturing in the next year. If you didn't have very many people maturing, that wouldn't cost too much, but it had wonderful marketing implications because you would be at the top of the league table. So it was a very cheap way of marketing to overcredit just for a short time to boost your performance. Richard Lyon pointed out to me that his dad had published this paper in 1987, which was, in fact, a very perceptive paper, warning of what was going to happen in the future. He said that life insurance companies basically loved having terminal bonuses because it let them have much more flexibility in what they could distribute. So for a lot of companies, the terminal bonuses became a more and more important component of the final payout. So Mr. Lyon was worried that this might lead to overcrediting, and there were references to bonus wars. And he also was worried that there was too much discretion, that now there were these large amounts of money that were going to be used for terminal bonuses, and the actuaries had a great deal of discretion about how that money would be spent, when it would be spent, who it would be given to. And there was very little transparency about how the decisions were made, which could lead to inequity. And he was 100% right. In the Equitable, for example, and some other life insurance companies, they decided to offer, quote, special treatment. That is, they gave extra bonuses to particular policies that would affect their performance rating. So they knew that the financial press reported on maturity values at durations of 15 and 20 years. So they boosted bonuses just for policies that were going to mature at the end of 15 or 20 years, and if they came up, that would make them appear higher in the performance league tables. This was obviously a lot of other offices were doing it because it was discussed at an actuarial meeting, and it was pointed out that not only was this inequitable, whereas actuaries were supposed to be concerned about equity, but it also created unrealistic expectations in the policyholders that those high performance high bonuses would be available to everyone, which they weren't. This was very important in the UK because there was actually a policyholder reasonable expectation which was built into both the legislation and the professional standards. Actuaries were required under professional standards to consider policyholder reasonable expectations when setting bonuses. In practice, the PRE was a completely nebulous, undefined term. Nobody knew what it meant. And I'm afraid the Equitable's actuary more or less decided we don't need to worry about that. Under the Articles of Association of the Equitable, the directors had absolute discretion to allocate any bonuses that they wanted to. And the neglect of this PRE requirement actually was a key component in the downfall of the Equitable, because I'm afraid that the courts took a different view to the Equitable's actuary about what was a fair method of distribution of surplus. I don't know what my time's going.
5 minutes.
Oh, we'll skip through this really quickly. Valuation of financial reporting. In the UK, you're supposed to have freedom with publicity, which means that it's very important to have complete and accurate disclosure. The financial advisors used the publicly available information to make recommendations as to which companies were strong. And there was a temptation, therefore, to fudge the published accounts for marketing purposes. And it was very easy because there were lots of loopholes in the regulatory solvency standards. Lots. The Equitable's reported solvency was overstated for several years before it closed. And most of the loopholes were perfectly legal, but should, in my opinion, should never have been allowed. One of the problems was that Mr. Ransom was both the appointed actuary responsible for the valuation, and he was also at the same time the CEO of the society, responsible for meeting the society's growth goals. So he was both appointed actuary and CEO from 1991 to 1997, which led to a conflict of his roles. The regulators didn't think this was a good idea. The auditors didn't think it was a good idea. The people on the board of the society didn't think it was a good idea, but Mr. Ransom was a very, very strong-minded person, and he basically overrode all their objections. In the Penrose report afterwards, it said there should never again be any possibility of somebody having both those roles at the same time. My paper I've written includes lots of flaws in the reserving process, but we don't have time to go through them all now. But I will skip over that because I've run out of time. A lot of them are, in my opinion, pretty dodgy. The weaker the equitable became, the more adjustments were used to improve the reported solvency of the company. And the regulator was very helpful in this regard. They kept giving the equitable approval to use all sorts of loopholes, which required regulatory discretion. So the problem with regulatory discretion is the regulators often use it for the benefit of saving the insurance company rather than for saving the policyholders. The parliamentary ombudsman later strongly criticised the equitable, the regulator for letting them basically get away with it. And the people who joined the equitable later on, shortly before it became insolvent, later had lawsuits saying that they had been misled about the strength of the company. Here's a nasty quote from Lord Penrose, who was really quite scathing about a lot of the actuarial techniques that were used to make the company look solvent while actually just letting it get deeper and deeper into trouble. So the real problem hit when the guaranteed annuity options came into the money. They'd sold these policies for like 30 years up till 1988, and they actually strengthened the guarantees in 1975. At the time they were sold, they were out of the money. No one ever thought they would cost anything. They didn't set aside any reserves for it. They didn't charge anything for the guarantees. But this is where things went wrong. This shows the interest rates on UK gilts. When they were selling these policies, gilt rates were, you know, up around 12%. But by the 1990s, gilt rates had sharply fallen, so the annuities were in the money. This is mortality rates were also improving over time. This is the life expectancy of a 65-year-old in 1970, and this is the life expectancy in 2000. So as a result, the Equitable's guarantees were in the money. This purple line shows their guaranteed rate, and the yellow line shows the Equitable Life's market-based rate. So an option first came into the money in 1993, recovered slightly, and then the options became more and more in the money as towards the end of the 1990s. So the Equitable had a terrible dilemma. How were they going to pay for these guarantees which were in the money? They didn't have any estate. So they only had two options. Either they could reduce the bonuses for everybody, in which case the people without the guarantee would be cross-subsidising the people with the guarantee. And the Equitable's actuaries thought that this was not a fair way of dealing with the problem, because it meant that these the people without the guarantees would get considerably less than their asset share. Second option was actually really pretty ingenious. They said, let's reduce bonuses, but only for the people who take up the guarantee. Effectively, what this did was make the guarantee completely worthless. Well, almost completely, not quite, but almost completely worthless. Of course, this would breach the policyholders' reasonable expectations. They assumed that the guarantee was actually, you know, a good thing to have, and it wasn't in line with what they produced in their marketing documents, but they decided to go for option two, and they called it the differential terminal bonus policy. Someone who had $80,000, someone who had an asset share of $100,000, would have $80,000 built up in their fund, they called it the cash fund, and then they would get this terminal bonus of $20,000, which would put them up to $100,000. The current annuity rate at 9% would give them a pension of $9,000 per annum. Now, if this other guy over here, he had a 10% guaranteed annuity rate, they said, well, what we have to do is make sure that the value of the benefit is exactly the same for both people.
So they basically worked backwards and said, okay, if we reduce his terminal bonus to 10,000 pounds and do all the calculations, it'll work out right.
I'm going to keep going even though I'm building.
So naturally, they didn't tell anyone about this decision. In fact, they were quite sneaky about it. Mostly, they didn't even tell people that they were eligible to have a guarantee at all. If they didn't know, they didn't tell them. They didn't tell them that they were going to reduce their bonuses to offset the guarantee, and they made some rather vague comments. One of the actuaries admitted in an internal memo that what they were doing was a bit sneaky. Did they think no one would notice? Well, okay. They started getting some really negative publicity. The Equitable is not so equitable. And I'll skip over. A lot of other life offices were doing the same thing. I'll just skip right down to the end. I'll skip over reserving issues, which are actually really important. What happened is eventually it went to court. There was a test case. The Equitable said, we have the right to declare any bonuses we want. What we're doing is fair because everyone will get their asset share, and we never promised we'd give anyone any terminal bonuses anyway. We always said they could go down. But the House of Lords said, no, you need to take account of policyholder reasonable expectations. You gave a guarantee. You gave lots of marketing illustrations to show how it would work. You created those policyholder reasonable expectations by what you told people. And you don't have unlimited discretion. You have to take account of policyholder reasonable expectations. So they said what the Equitable had been doing, reducing the final bonuses in order to negate the guarantee, was not allowed. So the aftermath was the day after the House of Lords decision came out, they estimated they have a $1.5 billion shortfall. The company went up for sale within the next few days because they needed a capital injection to survive. After a bunch of due diligence, there were no buyers because when they actually looked at the accounts, they realized that the Equitable was in serious, serious difficulties and it would cost a lot of money to get them out. And when the last potential buyer quit, the company had to close to new business. Anyway, there's a lot more interesting complications in the story, but that's all we have time for today.
Okay. Thank you for that, Shauna. I think this presentation, you also got a paper.
Yes, it's a paper.
So that should be available on the website, so I encourage people to fill that out. But in the meantime, if you can join me in thanking Shauna.